Today on the Forcecast, we are talking to one of my former managers, somebody I've wanted to get on this podcast since I first started it, Tony Pulis. He told us the truth about actually discovering Rory Delap could chuck that ball as far as he can, managing and moulding Adama Traore, the truth behind those Serge Gnabry stories that everybody loves to talk about, and the brutal 5:30 a.m. pre-season wake-ups in Austria. Up the Forcecast.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Tony, welcome to the Forcecast, mate. We have to start here. We have to. It's been spoken about so many times. I've spoken about it. I love talking about it. The mythical, magical pre-season tour, the Tony Pulis pre-season tour of Austria. Talk me through it. I used to love it, by the way.
I was going to say, if you listen to a lot of the lads over the clubs that, you know, I was lucky enough to take out there, most of them now, not the time, Ben, but most of them now just look back at it with so much enjoyment and pleasure and great memories that, makes me wonder, was I too soft with you?
No, I thought you had it absolutely bob on. At that moment in time, don't get me wrong, when you're getting that wake-up call at 5:30, because this is how it used to work, by the way. So we used to do wake-up calls at 5:30. The phone would ring in your room. Yeah, the phone would ring. There's no escaping it, okay? You don't get to trust your alarm or anything. The phone's ringing in your room at 5:30. You're downstairs for about 6 o'clock-ish, and then you're straight walking out to the hills, aren't you?
On the bikes at 6.
Yeah.
We're leaving unless you were on the bikes and then you'd get fined. Yeah, so we'd leave at 6, cycle round, get a little bit of a warm-up, and then park the bikes at the bottom of the hill on the running days. You never did running days. You just stayed on the bike. And then, off we went. And afternoon, once we finished that, back for breakfast. Most of the lads would go and have a sleep.
Yeah.
And we'd get up, we'd go in the big gymnasium, and we, you know, leave it to the medical team to do, you know, a little bit of stretching
and all that,
you know, head tennis or whatever they wanted to do. And then have a little bit of lunch, a little sleep, and then down to the training ground at about 5 o'clock at night for a couple of hours on the grass.
A bit of a football session.
So it was ball work in the afternoon, kind of fitness work in the morning.
Yeah, I always thought it was best off getting the hard work done as early as we possibly could. And most of the lads embraced it and realised that if they didn't get their rest, they would struggle. So the lads would go to, me and Kempy would stay up a little bit later, and you'd never see lads walking around the hotel. They were always ready to go the next day.
You wouldn't see them walking around the hotel because Tony would demand, I guarantee, do not go walking around this hotel, all right? You need to lie down on your bed.
That's exactly how
it went, I promise you. Do not go walking around, lie down on your bed and get ready for the afternoon.
So how hard were these, because they are legendary, these kind of hill work. How hard was it, Ben? I mean, you're probably not the best person to ask because, as Tony said, you cried off with your knees.
I would be on the bikes. It was sensible, wasn't it?
No, well, I've got to be honest with you. A lot of the lads found the cycling harder than the running.
Yeah, true. Yes, true.
So, because their legs weren't, and they weren't used to cycling, they would find cycling really, really difficult. A lot of them, most of them would get up there. We'd split them up. We'd have the top three or four runners who would go off first. And we'd grade the runners how we thought, you know, their strengths were in respect of running and endurance. It was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant. It was a brilliant way of getting strength into the players as much as anything else. The conditioning work then obviously was afternoons, and being on the grass was the evenings. But I really wanted to put the miles in the leg, but not only the miles in the legs, also getting those legs strong enough that they wouldn't pick up injuries. And a lot of people have said to me, I can remember having... taking some criticism from scientists and all these people saying that running up hills is no good. Running down hills is no good.
Yeah.
Because then you can pick up injuries. But what we did, we had the golf carts at the top of the hill. So once the lads had finished at the top, the golf carts would take the lads down the hill. So the hills were so steep that they'd no chance of pulling muscles because they couldn't go that fast to pull a muscle anyway. So they'd get the strength in their legs.
Yeah.
And I think the doc, he moaned and groaned about and said that this wasn't good. It was on concrete. It was this, that, and the other. Then I think one year, Benny went to America, didn't he, and did a thesis on it. And said, changed his tune. Because the injury, you know, we planned it that we wouldn't get... A pre-season is all about, not about results, it's about preparing the lads mentally and physically for the games when the season kicks off. And we didn't want injuries. We had a group, didn't we, Ben? Yeah. We had a smashing group of players. And we wanted to keep them fit. You know, it wasn't a massive group of players. We had young kids involved in it as well. But the players who were important, it was important we kept them fit.
So there was two different hills at the hotel we used to stay at. So this place in Austria, Hotel Schloss Pischlein, it was called. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah, gorgeous place.
There were two different hills. One was... It was a bit longer, not so steep. So I'd say, about a kilometre long, maybe? Yeah. Maybe a little bit longer, maybe. Yeah. And then there was another one, which was, it was a bugger. It was shorter, but it was so steep. It was brutally steep, in fact. So then on them days, when I'm doing the bike on the steep hills, and some of the other lads did bikes, that was so painful. So I think the lads actually used to prefer the kilometre long track that was a bit more of a slow
up
drag,
and down,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
But we had Vans to bring us back down, and... Like I say, the lads would moan about it, but I think once that was done, they knew the hard work was done for the day, and it was like, 8 o'clock, half past eight or something like that?
Yeah, we finished.
The hard work was done for the day, and then the rest of it was just the football. But I've got to say, honestly, hand on heart, I used to love it so much.
Well, this was, seven, 8 years ago, and obviously that was when you were kind of on your bike probably...
This is West Brom,
West Brom. So how hard did you find those hills in relation to stuff you do on the bike?
They were really tough, to be fair, because we were on mountain bikes, weren't we, Tony?
Yeah.
So, and don't get me wrong, they were decent mountain bikes, but when you're on a big, heavy mountain bike trying to get up a hill, like you would go out in the afternoons, wouldn't you? Yeah. You'd bully the staff into going out in the afternoon.
I'd get Gouldie and them out there and I'd take them round the other side and it'd take us 40 minutes to get up the top. coming back obviously was easier, but I used to love it. But they're not racing bikes.
No.
They're not, you know, the proper bikes that I was fortunate enough to have a bike made for me by Brian Rourke and his company, absolutely fabulous. And you sit on it, so light, and the change of the gears and everything else is so much easier. You jump on these, and
tires
then it's
like that.
Yeah, it's different. It's more difficult, but. Again, we're there for that purpose, really, to make it difficult.
Yeah, I remember you were the same as me, Tony. We were always the first ones into the bike shed in the morning. We would
looking for the best ones.
Getting the best bikes with the most pressure in the tyres, the gears that move nicer.
Yeah.
Do you remember the one time when our hotel, obviously, top of the hill, we had to go down the hill to get to the training ground, and we were just around the corner from the training ground. I think you've just gone over a curb or something like that, and your entire back wheel has come out of the bike.
And someone saved me.
so I'm behind the manager, I'm behind Kempy at this point, and I just see the gaffer just sprawling along the floor. Genuinely, he's absolutely stacked it. I'm like, what on earth is going on here? Some of the lads obviously bang out of order, like giggling because it's the manager kind of thing. I'm thinking, he could have really hurt himself here. Anyway, I sort of pick him up, have a look at the bike. His whole back wheel, like the quick release, fully loose, fully off, right? His back wheel's fully came off, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not saying somebody sabotaged the bike.
Someone's been dropped.
I'm still looking for the person who did it.
Who's your best bet for that?
Kempy.
So with the Austrian trips then, with the running in particular, you were obviously riding, Ben. Let's talk about the players. Who liked it? Who loathed it?
Well, there's one that stuck out for me, Tony, but what about you?
James McLean was just absolutely phenomenal. I've seen some athletes and I've worked with some really, really top players in respect of their fitness levels. But James was just, I love James as well.
Yeah.
You know, he's a genuine lad. He's a bit scatty, but he's genuine. And I really, really took to him as a person, as an individual. But he'd set off. You just couldn't believe. You know, he was leaving really good runners behind by 100 yards.
Yeah, easy.
Easy. He was just phenomenal.
It's like he just didn't touch the floor, wasn't it? Like his whole foot wouldn't touch the floor. It was just his tiptoes.
Yeah.
And he would just float
up. I can remember the, was it the last season, Ben, where he went, he decided to go vegan.
Yeah, he did. I forgot about this.
So I didn't realise he was doing this. So he decided he was going to go vegan. So we set off and he does about, we'd always do, I think it was 16 hills, four sets of four. And the first four, he's absolutely murdered. Then he's come over the line, I think, on the last of the first, the longest runs. And I feel a bit sick. So I said, James, you don't need fitness, mate. If you don't feel very well, you know, it's the others that I'm more concerned about, not you. And he went, no, I think it's what I'm eating at the moment. So I said, what are you eating? He said, oh, I've gone vegan. I said, for goodness sake, James, when did you start? Oh, couple of days ago, what, before pre-season? And that was James. You know, he was scatty.
He's at Wrexham now, isn't he?
He's
obviously at Wrexham. So the first day of training at Wrexham. So I was always the first one in the gym, the more on the bike, that. And I've gone up there and I can just hear sort of like ropes getting whacked against the floor. I've gone in the gym and he's already in there. He's been in there easily for about 45 minutes, right? Full on sweat on. He's doing a complete like circuit or something. And I'm thinking, just same old James.
We had, it was the boxer who came in at West Brom.
Oh, gosh,
what was his name?
Oh, yeah.
Very, very famous, great boxer.
I can't remember. I know him,
boxer from the Midlands. He used to come in and he took some boxing drills for the lads. And he came in one day afterwards and knocked on my door, popped in, and just said to me, if James McLean wasn't a footballer, I'm telling you, he would be a top boxer.
Yeah, decent.
He's so quick. His movement and everything else, so quick, it's frightening.
Can I tell you a few sneaky stories about James McLean, actually?
Please do.
So he was loving his boxing, right? He used to love it, and he would go and enter like white-collar boxing events.
What, whilst playing?
Whilst playing, and even at West Brom, this was. He turned in one day, right? So he was doing this, and a couple of us knew about it. He turned in one day, and he broke his hand. Yeah. So we were like, James, what are you doing, mate? And he was like, no, what do you want? I slipped over. And he's got like a black eye. His hand's all over, this, like shredded to bits, his knuckle. And we're like, James, come on. And he's proper got it, but he carried on playing, obviously, sort of thing. He just had to hide it. But yeah, he proper got involved in it. He's really good at it.
He was, seriously, for all the stick he got for his, you know, his political views and everything else, I don't think there's a nicer lad.
Yeah, true that. Great lad.
You could meet.
Yeah.
He was really... top. Lad.
And with him going to Wrexham now, because when they signed him, because he's 34 now, and I think I saw a couple of comments on like social media we were talking about earlier on saying, oh, he's a bit old. And I thought, no. James McLean, he'd be playing when he's 50.
He'd be playing when he's 50.
Fantastic
James.
Signing.
Yeah. Absolutely easy. Another pre-season tour we went on, Tony, a Hong Kong tour. Do you remember this one?
Yeah, I do.
It was a washout, wasn't
it? Yeah,
it was a shambles.
It was an absolute, it was the Premier League.
Yeah, that was it. Trophy or something.
Yeah, Liverpool, yeah. Crystal Palace and us. And we turned up at the ground that we were supposed to train on, and the grass was awful. It was full of water. It was most probably the worst pre-season.
It was monsoon season,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, it was monsoon season. It was most probably the worst pre-season that I've ever done in respect to preparation for a season to start. Because what we used to do, we used to go, Ben will tell you, we used to go Austria, come back for a couple of days and fly out to America. Mm. So I'd always go the East Coast that time of year because of the humidity. So the lads then would play three games a week. We'd cut back on how hard we worked them because we knew the humidity. So we shortened the training, so they were doing shorter, sharper stuff, but they were struggling with, obviously, oxygen and the humidity. So the balance of running up the hills, in altitude, and the, you know, six games in America in the 2 weeks, really was really good grounding for the first 2 weeks of pre-season. And we missed that because we had to go to Hong Kong.
How frustrating is that when the lads have done such hard work in Austria? They've got that fitness level. Everybody's fit as a fiddle, good to go. And then I think we got back maybe the week before the season started, and you've had basically 2 weeks as a washout. Can't really do anything properly. It just gets right in the way, doesn't it?
Yeah, Ben will tell you about preparation and organisation and all. And for me, it just, you know, it was a money. You know, it wasn't about football. It was about, you know, the Premier League, really working alongside their sponsors and getting people and getting clubs to go places that a lot of them really don't really want to go.
And is that a difficult dynamic as the manager? Because obviously you manage your team. So you have to
accept it. You know, it's part and parcel of what is the greatest league in the world. And, you know, they have to sell it and they want to sell it to different countries. And rightly so. So, you have to jump on and make the best of it.
I want to stay on West Brom for a little bit, please, Tony, if that's okay, because I've got a personal story, a fantastic story that I love, actually. I absolutely love this one. It was when I did my cruciate, okay? So I did my cruciate. I was out for the best part of 9 months. And then I got back into the team. Boaz Mile did a fantastic job, but I got back into the team. And very quickly, after our first two or three games, I remember you pulled me at training. You said, "You're not talking enough. You're not talking enough."
I can remember down on the bottom bench.
There you go. So he said, "You're not talking enough." And I was like, "Well, I am." And you went, "No, you're not. You're not talking enough." And so we did the training session. And after the training session, he said, "You're still not talking enough." And I was like, well, I walked off. I was fuming. I was like, I am. I know I'm talking enough. I know I am. The next day, training, "You're not talking." "Oh my God, all right. It's getting a bit prickly now." So he said, "Right, tomorrow we're going to get down on this bottom pitch and we're going to get some of the young lads down and we're going to get balls into the box. We're going to go crosses, we're going to go corners, free kicks, and I want to hear you talking, yeah? You're going to have four defenders in front of you and I want to hear you talking to them and I want to hear what you say." So we're doing the session. "You're not talking enough." And I'm going, "Fuck off, I am. I am. I know I am." And he went, "You're not talking." So we carry on and he goes, "Give me some press-ups now." I was like 35 at the time and I was fuming, right? I was like, "I'm not giving you any press-ups." He went, "Get down and give me some press-ups now." And I went, "No chance," right? And Boaz was behind the goal, right? And Boaz was just like, if he could have picked a hole in the ground and just let it sink him up, he was like going, "Oh, no."
And Goldie.
Yeah, and Goldie was there as well.
Is this a stand-up at this point?
Oh, it was horrible, right? But I fully thought I was in the right, genuinely, right? I fully thought I was in the right, right? So anyway, we kind of got to an impasse where I wasn't doing the press, but he was still getting his point across. So anyway, the next game, I thought, "Joe, I'm going to show you. I'm going to talk like you wouldn't believe," right? I think we ended up winning the game and I was talking to my defenders, but I played a really good game. And I thought, "Joe, what? I think I've played a good game because I was talking loads," right? Genuinely. But what it does is, he used to say to me, it keeps you in the game, Ben, yeah? He says, your defenders don't need to look behind them to see where you are because they can hear you and it will keep you in the game and it keeps them in the game. It keeps them on their toes. They know what's happening.
But it keeps you mentally involved as well, right?
Exactly that.
Concentration.
That's what it was, wasn't it? But you must come up against this so often where you're trying, it's like banging your head against a brick wall, isn't it? You're trying to get through to players.
I just think there's certain positions and certain areas in a pitch where concentration levels are so much more important than maybe other positions. Goalkeeper and two centre halves, the spine of the team, the start of the spine of the team. You might be out of possession, but on the turnover, if you're not in the right position or you're not switched on, and it shows week in, week out, you know, counter attacking football and people scoring off turnovers is enormous in every league, not just the Premier League, but every league. And I think, and Ben would have heard me saying it to centre-halves that we've played, when we're attacking, we could be at our most dangerous. And that's when you've got to be really switched on. Because if we lose the ball and we're caught, you know, I can remember against Leicester where Gareth got caught, messing about with it. Vardy took it off him and scored against us. It's one of those things where it's safety first because you're open, because you're attacking. If there's a turnover and there's any danger, you've got to make sure you deal with it. If you don't, you can get punished. Well, you will get punished, especially in the Premier League.
So what do you make of... I used to love playing for you. I used to love playing for you because I used to know exactly what I was doing at any given moment. I did. It was so simple. Yeah. It was black or white. Even the defenders in front, they knew exactly what they were doing. You look at some of the teams in the Premier League now, like Burnley, for example, just been promoted, and they're still trying to play this certain way of football. Sometimes, surely, you must watch that and just think, wow, boys, you're going to have to simplify it a little bit.
Well, I think they have an identity, they have a philosophy, and I think the most important thing is I hate going to football games and watching teams and I can't find an identity. I can't find what they're trying to do or what they're trying to achieve. I think when you get in the Premiership, what you have to understand, and Burnley's obviously he's a young manager, he's been a fantastic player. What they have to understand is that there's such a difference in levels in respect of turnovers, what we've just talked about. In the Championship, you can get away with it a little bit. In the Premier League, teams will kill you. So if you give the ball away and you're open and you're stretched, they will, 9 times out of 10, they'll get straight down your throats and either score or
What is that? Is that pace? Is it? Is that?
I think it's everything,
edge?
Ben. I think it's the fitness levels. Obviously, you know, they're fitter, stronger, bigger. But technically, you know, technically they're
Bob, right.
They can get those passes off, Ben, quicker and more decisive. I think than what.
Yeah, the cutting edge is incredible.
The cutting edge is.
I think people overlook how physically fast and fit and strong and. These Premier League, if you look at a Premier League footballer nowadays, I promise you, so most of them are about 6 foot, maybe a little bit shorter.
Yeah.
But their strength and their speed
is phenomenal.
It's outrageous, isn't it?
It's phenomenal. And I like I say, you know, we talk about Burnley, we talk about other clubs and other teams, and everybody wants to play this expansive football now. Everybody wants the goalkeeper involved. Everybody wants to do this, that, and the other. It's completely different. To my philosophy, was always trying to win football matches and get the best out of the players I've got and play in that way. When I was at Stoke, we were a big, strong, physical side and we played to it. You know, we made it difficult to come to the Bet365 stadium. Clubs found it difficult because of the way we played, the way we were perceived. And at the end, we weren't as direct as what teams thought, but we played to the fact that we were direct. When I went to West Brom, I went to Palace. We had two wingers, Puncheon and Bolasie, who were absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Shamak was a tremendous number 10. He could play, was a good footballer. And Cameron Jerome was up front. You know, he'd chase paper bags in a windy stadium and keep chasing it and keep chasing it and keep chasing it. So he was willing. So I had to change a little bit. They weren't. Cameron wasn't Crouchy or Ken Wynn or Fuller. He was a different type of player. The two wingers gave us that option to counter quickly. That both of them wanted to run forward. So I had to change my dynamics for the team. When I went to West Brom, Ben will tell you. It was such a mishmash that first season I took over. You know that they had Sampras and. A bunch of players. It was very difficult.
Samaras. I was just thinking. Samaras. He's a tennis player, Pete.
Yeah. Yeah, Samaras.
George Samaras.
You know, we had people like that. They just and in the end, I had to work out how could we be strong enough to keep clean sheets and to win games. We weren't a great team, but going forward, especially. But our strength was really two centre halves.
Yeah.
Ben in goals. Dorse. We had really good players. The great thing about West Brom, and I say to people, it was the hardest job really trying to find a way of playing. If you look at Morrison, Brunt, Ben, McCauley, Olsen, Gads, you had real good, strong characters there. What you had to do really was around it, you had to put things in place that would enable you to win games. And we almost played with two, it was the little black winger we had.
Sessegnon,
who played now and then, didn't play always. Otherwise, I'd play Gads and James White, James Morrison or Brunty. They were players that would play inside the pitch. So we had to work a system there. And we used to drop Brown and Berry, you know, off onto midfield player, onto the opponent's midfield players, let their centre-halves have it, play really tight and compact, and then break from there. So there's different ways and different systems you can use to win football matches. What I don't believe is that everybody should play the same. And I don't believe that it suits everybody to play the same.
Yeah.
So as a manager and as a coach, you've got to look at the strengths you've got and the weaknesses that you've got, and you've got to work towards those strengths. That's management for me. That's coaching and management. It's looking at what you've got and then putting together a team that can go out, not only compete, you have to win.
Is would you say then that Crystal Palace stint, because I think it was only 22 or 3 matches or something like that, would you say that's probably your proudest sort of, I know it was only a short stint, but to win manager of the year for those 20 odd whatever games and to get, I think Palace finished 11th that season from absolutely staring down the barrel of it as well.
We Ben, I think going, I took over from Ollie and Ian had had problems here, there and everywhere. I don't think he was sure of his team. We had a real good Christmas. We brought in Scott Dan, Joe Ledley.
Solid.
Hennessy.
Yeah.
But right down the middle of the pitch, we brought players in. You know, Tom Ince came as a youngster as well to give us a little bit more if we needed it up front. And so Christmas and the window was big for us. But we had a good balance. What is always important for me in teams is a good balance. Mm. And like I say, the two wide players and Shamak were our quality. The rest of the team, Ledley and Jedinek were fabulous protecting the two centre-halves. You know, they were fabulous. Two fullbacks did a good job defensively. Didn't get forward that much because we didn't need them, because we had two wingers, punctured playoff people and go past people. And Yala was just absolutely outstanding when I went there. He'd win game for us by ourselves. So the balance was as good as anything I'd work with, really.
As if you're a winger playing for a Tony Pulis.
Oh, no, you have to work.
Wouldn't you have to work, but if you're on his side. So it's a genuine thing. And people, again, fans won't notice this or recognise this, but obviously the team switches round at half time. But if you're on Tony Pulis' side by that dugout and you're a winger, you are not getting a moment's peace. James McLean used to say this to me all the time. He would say, oh, this first half's going to be a nightmare. And I'm like, why? Because TP's there. TP is right on my shoulder, basically, just shouting at me, go on, get up, get up.
Well, I had Traore at Middlesbrough. Adama. Adama is fabulous. What a lovely... Honestly, Ben, what a lovely lad.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. And I think he cost Middlesbrough £10 million. When I got there, he wasn't in the team. And I think it was our first training session or second training session. I can remember Kempy coming over to me and saying, have you seen that kid run? It was like off the scales.
A bullet.
It was just unbelievable. And I said to Dave, I said, well, he's got to be in the team, haven't he? And he said, yeah. So what I used to do, because Adama was very enthusiastic, lacked a little bit of self-belief and self-confidence. And so what I used to do, he used to play on my side both halves.
That's it, yeah.
And, you know, I would try and talk him through the game. I'd shout my, you know, I'd come in hoarse after the game, but I would try and help him in that way. And in the end, you know, I used to cuddle him after games because he did so well for us and ended up having a great move.
When you say help him through the game, do you genuinely mean sort of just tell him where to go, and what?
I'll tell you what I told him. I said, Adama, you have so much pace. Mm. Whatever you do, don't turn back. So you either take him on. We worked, I took him for individual sessions after training on coming inside and using his left foot, because people knew he was quick and cut off the outside of the pitch at times. So I said, if they do that, Adama, just come in. And I don't care if you smash it wide or whatever, come in once or twice. That'll put doubt in his mind and he'll leave that space outside. But no, generally, Ben, I would play that side for when we lost the ball.
Yeah.
And I'd ask him just to run in front of the fullback, just get in that space. Don't have to do nothing else, Adama. You just get in that space. And sometimes he'd lose it and just switch off. And I'd be on to him straight. When he go, oops, here we go, and off he'd go. But no, he shrunk about 4 or 5 inches by the time he'd finished playing with me as well.
One thing you said about giving him a cuddle after the game, Tony, how important is it, obviously, as a manager, to flex your style? Because obviously you hear it a lot in football about an arm around the shoulder or some players needing a carrot and a stick.
Yeah, I'd most probably be, well, Ben will tell you, I'd most probably be really honest and too honest at times and then afterwards think, oh, I shouldn't have said that or shouldn't have done that, you know, or Kempy had come up and said something.
Can't say that, Toby.
It's too blunt, you know, you're going to have to give him a cuddle because, you know, he might take that the wrong way. But I think I work with and I try to have as many genuine players as I possibly could with me. And genuine people, I think, accept a little bit of criticism and they accept it when I think it goes well for them. I think if you're criticising and criticising and criticising and you keep knocking them and knocking them and knocking them, you know, it's like a dog. They're just going to crawl in the corner and not be any use for you. I think criticise, then cuddle them.
A bit of love, yeah.
And try and find the balance. And some people are different to others. You know you can have an argument and a fight with someone and he's not going to be affected by it. And others, you can feel there's a little bit of... whether you've taken a bit of air out of their system and they need, you know, pumping up again.
And when you bring in players, is that something that you and the team will get a gauge of before you sign them? Their kind of personality, their character?
When I was at Portsmouth with Milan Mandrić, he said to me, we did a similar job at Palace at Portsmouth. We joined Alan Ball, bless him, had been manager before I was there. And we came in for about 20-odd games and they were, I think, second from bottom, about 4 or 5 points adrift. There was about 52 players there. So we had to sort, like, sort everything out and then pick a team to keep us up. And we got good. We signed some good, again, Sean Derry, Kevin Harper, Kwasi, people like that, good players, good who I knew and I knew I would be good with and they would be good for me. So we had them at quite a young age, brought them in and it turned it a little bit. But he said to me one day, what do you look for in a player? And I go, character, character and character. And he said, what about ability? I said, well, I think I can improve them within what I want to do. But the three main points, I like good people around me.
I think that's probably, well, certainly at this moment in time in the Premier League is probably the biggest thing about, so take Man United, for example. I don't see any of that, Tony. I really don't.
No, I think it's very difficult now to look at two or three teams and say they're as good as what they were prior. And I think a club has to have an identity, whichever way you look at it, and it has to be led. And there has to be people taking responsibility to lead those players. Because Ben will tell you, players are the worst in the world for making excuses and looking for reasons why they're not playing well or why the team's not playing well and this, that and the other. And you need to prop them up, but you also need to make sure that they know the direction you're going in and what you want. And if you don't, if they don't perform or act that way, then I think you've got to get rid of them as quickly as you possibly can.
Yeah, they can turn two turns into four to eight.
You've said it, haven't you, Ben? So many times when we've done the podcast about having just a foundation of good lads.
Yeah.
How important
it'll get
it is.
You everywhere.
And I think the everyday fan will overlook that and go, well, no, it's the players we need. But actually, they're the kind of backbone of that football club, aren't they, then?
Yeah. I think with every club, I think you get to a point where you put stability into it and you put good organisation and you get results. And supporters will go, yeah, there's been an improvement. But they'll want more and they'll want more and they'll want more. So they'll want to force, you know, we're not flamboyant enough. We're not creating enough chances. We're not scoring enough chances. We're not doing this. And some managers then drift away from what is really, really important. And that's when it all caves in, really. And falls the pitch because he might have signed three or four technically better players, but they're fluffy.
Yeah.
And when the pressure's on, you know, they're just not there to be seen.
Fluffy. Oh, it's true. There's so many fluffy ones, honestly. I remember when you signed him for West Brom, and I remember the lads were like, Fozzie, what's he like? Because obviously I worked with Tony at Stoke when I was a kid, when I was 18 years old. Yeah. And I was like, oh, lads, I love him. Seriously, he scares the life out of me, genuinely. I just remember being an 18-year-old kid. I'd hear your voice down the corridors at the Britannia at Stoke, and I would jump into a closet. I would just hide. I would do anything I could just to not see you. Honestly, I was petrified. But I was like, as I got older, I realised that it's so important to have. And I was saying to the lads, I was like, lads, this is going to be brilliant, because I knew we had a good core of lads, but we had a few, like you say, fluffy ones around the edges that had just been allowed to get away with stuff. They'd been allowed to get away with stuff, basically. And I was like, you wait, lads, honestly, them ones who think they can take the piss all the time, no chance when he walks.
So here's a question for you then, because I think we didn't quite answer it. So earlier on when Tony was giving you grief about not talking and you played that game. So when you came off the pitch that day, Ben, what was there a conversation? Or?
I don't know.
No, not at all. I think if you get after someone, and I used to get after Johnny as well, didn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's Johnny, sorry?
Johnny Evans.
I'd get after Johnny. I think with certain people, you look at them and you think, they're intelligent enough. They'll eventually take it on board and see that maybe there is an angle there that, you know, has helped them a little bit.
Yeah.
And I you have to accept that with characters and with strong characters, you are going to have that. There's going to be a little bit of bone against bone. But, you know, to get the best out of them and to make sure the team is in, you know, is important, which it is, you know, the team is everything. These players, they have to realise that they're so big and so important in that team that, you know, as, you know, Kemp used to always say to me, why do you always pick on the biggest players? And I used to always say, because they're the most important for the team, because everybody else they'll look up to him playing for England, look up to Johnny for playing for Ireland, for playing for Manchester United. Fletch was the same. You know, those players, they're the ones that I'd get after rather than the younger boys.
Still learning it.
Yeah, Yeah, all the time.
It's amazing though, isn't it, Ben? You said about what you learn about that story then, and you were 35.
Exactly that, 35. You think you know it all. Even as a 25-year-old, you probably think you know it all, don't it? But as a 35-year-old, I thought, no, he's wrong. I know he's wrong. I know I'm right. I know I'm right. And I wasn't. But I took it in. So the reason why I carried on playing probably till I'm 40, because my performance level stayed high because I would stay in game. So I learned something at 35 years old.
I really good story about that is that when I was at Stoke the first time, and we it was like Battersea's dog zone, really. We had all the strays coming in. The Icelandics were in charge.
Yeah, yeah.
And we couldn't bring any real top young players in. So we had Taggart and Michael Dubry as centre-halves. Two great lads. Tag's left-footed. Honest, solid, head and kick, everything in front of him. You turn him round and he struggled like you couldn't believe it. And then you had Michael Dubry, who was quick, powerful, again, great lad. So Michael had won a race. He'd be quite happy to get right up tight on the halfway line and people to play it behind because he'd beat anybody. He was that quick. Now, he's playing with Tags. You get up on the halfway line with Tags. He didn't want space behind whatever. So we're doing a coaching session one day, and I'm saying to Michael, Mac, that side of him, Michael, so they can't play up the side view. Well, why do I want to do that? I'm quick. I won that race. Yeah, but you've got Tags who's alongside you. He doesn't want to be doing that because as soon as you turn him, he's going to struggle. He wants to play in front of him. And it took me quite a few sessions to get Tags, to get Michael to understand what we were trying to do. And in the end, the more I spoke to Michael about it, the more Tags got involved and Tags convinced him that that was the best way to play.
Tags was brilliant. I was there with Tags. I was there with Dubry as well. Tags was brilliant.
Honestly, Tags was fabulous. Yeah. I've got some great stories about Tags.
I don't know if you could tell after them ones.
He's going to kill me on this. So we play at home. We get a good result at home. I can't remember who it was, against QPR or something like that. We win the game. And he says to me, Gaffer, he says, my uncle's cousin's nephew's sister's coming over from America to Belfast. He's right if I have Monday off. So, yeah, Tags, no problems, mate. Brilliant today. Brilliant. So off he goes. So Winnie...
Yeah,
kit lady. Monday, I say to Winnie, don't get Tags' kit out. He's not in today. He'll be in tomorrow. Tuesday arrives, text, nowhere to be seen. So I'm livid. So I've gone out training, done my bits and pieces, come in. It was a wet day. I'll never forget it. And Winnie calls me and she says, Tom, well, Gaffer, come here. If Tags is on the phone. She says, he's had a drink. So get on the phone. He says, Gaffer, Tags. So I said, yeah, where are you? He says, you can't believe it. He says, my auntie's uncle's cousin's nephew's niece's blinking whatever it was, decided to stay an extra couple of days. So I can't leave him here by myself. So he says, but I'll tell you this now. He says, honestly, he says, I'll be in Thursday. And he says, I'll be right as rain. So he turns up Thursday. He's all over the place. So he can't join in training. And we're doing shape, Ben, as we always did on a Thursday. So we're doing shape. So I says to Rudgy, walk him round the pitch, but make sure he's looking at what we're doing because he's playing Saturday. So Rudgy walked him round the pitch about once, took him in, and got him off. So I say to Rudgy, what was Tags like? You know, he's had a good couple of days. Okay, anyway, on the Friday, he pulls me. I don't have to pull him. He pulls me. He goes, Gaffer, have you got a minute? Yeah. He says, if we lose Saturday and I don't play well, you can have my wages. He said, I won't take him. And I said, okay, no problems, Tags. And left it. I started the ump with him. Yeah, no problems, Tags. We'll do it. Best player on the pitch?
Jerry Taggart.
Really?
Jerry. Oh, absolutely, it's so fan. Good, isn't
and
it?
He came in afterwards.
See?
There we are, Gaffer.
I love that.
And that was Jerry. He was just absolutely, fantastic. I really, really, a lot of time for him. He was an old-fashioned...
Yeah.
We had the Icelandic people there, and it was different to Peter Coates because Peter had the boardroom. When Peter was there, the boardroom was open, everybody would mix. The Icelandic people had a boardroom and then a little room for themselves that they used to go into. And after the game, I was never a boardroom person. I used to find I'd get a little bit nervous just in case someone said something and it was after the game and I'd flip or say something I shouldn't have said. So anyway, the one day we played at home again and had a good result. I think we won 2-0 against someone. So I went up and they were in their little room. So me and Kempe came in with us and we sat on this big long table. So they're chatting away. And one of the Icelandic directors turned to me and said, and they had Icelandic players there who they wanted me to play and I never played. One of them was a centre-half. So he said, can I ask you, Tony, why do you keep playing Jerry Taggart? So I said, well, I think he's the best centre-half we've got. He's lucky. So I'm looking and I'm thinking, he's played about 550 games.
He's
so
lucky, is he? Yeah.
So I go, oh yeah, what do you mean? He says, well, every time the ball goes in the box, just hits him on the head.
Oh my God.
So I did all my life. So I said, yeah, I said, he's been doing that for about 550 games. I said, thanks very much. We'll speak to you later.
But they were being serious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable.
That is unbelievable, isn't it?
Would you say Stoke is probably the team that you kind of are best well known for?
I think you spend 10 years at a football club, Ben, and I think it, you know, it it is ingrained in me in two respects. I really, really enjoy the area.
Yeah.
I thought the people
lovely
were
lovely people, aren't they?
Fabulous. And my relationship with Peter.
Yeah.
You know, even today, you know, they played down here the other week. You know, I sat with John. John Coach has now taken over. The family's just amazing. They're absolutely. I can't speak highly of them as individuals and collectively. They're just a very, very special family.
Yeah, that's
and they've done brilliant. You know, the firm, the Bet365, what Denise and John are involved in, and now most of the family with Peter there as well, obviously have been, that's phenomenal what they've done there. But as people, as human beings, the one thing I'll say, money has not changed that family at all.
Yeah.
They're just the same. They're so down to earth, and they're so kind. And you know, they'd be. You speak to my family about Peter and Deirdre and John and Denise and all of them, and they won't have a bad word said against them. They've been fabulous.
You did a lot of charity work in Stoke as well, didn't you?
Yeah, we worked. The first year I was there, Ben, I was told that there was an hospice just starting up, the Donna Louise, and we went down there and it had about 3 or 4 rooms and everything else. And I gradually took the players down there for Christmas and we did a little bit and then we got one or two of the players. We had a real good group of players there, mind. Really tremendous characters and people who would, again, do their own stuff for the hospice. And every 2 years then they decided to do something big to raise money. We'd got into the Premiership, so obviously they could use the football club, they could use the players, myself, to do stuff. And, you know, I had wonderful experiences, you know, Kilimanjaro, cycling from John O'Groats down to Land's End, you know, rowing from Tower Bridge to the Eiffel Tower, cycling from Paris to Le Havre, rowing across the Channel to Brighton and then walk from Brighton to London Bridge again. All those great, great memories for me, but fantastic for the hospice. And we just talked about the Bet365 and Denise. They have actually taken on and invested a lot of money in that hospice now. They don't like to tell anyone about it. They actually don't like to tell anyone about all the charity donations that they make, but they do. And they've really looked after that place as well.
I've got a brilliant story about the hospice. Actually, when we were at West Brom, Tony took the whole team there, and so they're showing us around, and it's obviously a kind of an emotional time, and we're walking around and stuff. And then they put a big video on for us, and it's Tony basically said, right then, lads, time to put your hands in your pockets. And he's fully sprung us on it all, yeah? He's gone, right, these forms going around. Everybody's going to be donating, I think it's a day's wage or 2 days' wage or something. Everybody's going to be donating a day or two's wages. So just sign it and then we'll just take it straight out of your bank account. And everybody's going, what? But once everybody's happy to do it, don't get me wrong, but it's like a bit of a peer pressure thing to start with. So the first, and then it's just like, well, you've got to do it now.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
And one thing nobody knows, and I've never said this publicly, but Victor Anachibi,
yeah,
actually, I don't know if you knew about it, Ben, actually put more.
Oh, did he put
in there? He added a lump of money there. And, you know, I had my moments with Victor. But, you know, what a great gesture.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Absolutely
that,
fantastic. And I'm not sure he'd want me even now to have said what I've just said, but he did.
Big gentle giant, wasn't he, Vic?
Yeah.
Big gentle giant. We've got plenty more to talk about, by the way. And this is thank you so much, Tony. I said this to you this morning when I first got here. I said this was one of my bucket list podcasts, honestly. Genuinely, I'm not joking. When we first started the podcast, it was Tony Pulis. We've always wanted to get Tony Pulis on. So I'm very happy we're here. I said to you earlier, off camera, I said, do you know who has scored the most goals for you in your management career? So a player that you've managed, who has scored the most goals for you? I've got like the top, I've got the top 10 here if you want it.
Go on then.
Give me the top one.
I wouldn't have a clue, it's been a Stoke player, hasn't it, for nearly 1300 games. It's got to be a Stoke player, hasn't it?
Stoke player, 50 goals.
Crouchy?
Nope.
Fuller.
Ricardo Fuller.
Yeah. Wow.
Second.
Another Stoke player.
Another Stoke player. 42 goals. This surprised me a little bit, actually.
I think I know it.
Liam?
Nope.
Lawrence?
Nope.
Cressy?
Nope.
Would John Waters be?
Nope. John Waters is third.
Yeah.
Second, Adi Akinbaye.
Oh, really?
Adi Akinbaye.
What a great lad he was.
Great
as well,
lad, isn't he?
Ah, oh, fabulous. Boy. Yeah. Yeah.
He fully took me under his wing, though, Stoke. Fabulous. He fully took me under his wing.
You know, we had a game, just a quick one on Adi. We had a game, he just joined us. I'd taken him from Crystal Palace on a loan. I'd taken over from Steve Cottrell. Steve had gone to Sunderland with Howard Wilkinson. And then I took over. George Burley was going to get the job. Yeah. Watched them play on a Wednesday night and pulled out for the job. you know, they got no chance of staying up. Anyway, I took over. And we got Adi. I'd had Adi at Gillingham, obviously. I bought him from Norwich, took him to Gillingham, which was fabulous, and then sold him for a massive profit to Bristol City. But anyway, this game, he ran from side to side to side of the pitch about five times, Ben. Honestly, non-stop. And the whole stand stood up. We were winning 1-0 and we were under pressure. And he just kept going from side to side. And Ben will tell you what he was like. He was just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, honest as a day, wasn't he? Honest as a
fantastic.
Day.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And then we've got Carla Saba, Kenwyn Jones.
Sabs, yeah.
Liam Lawrence, Gifton Noel Williams.
Yeah.
Crouchy, Solomon Rondon.
Yeah.
Ryan Shawcross and Mamadi Sidibe.
Yeah. Yeah.
They complete the top 10. Yeah. Another quick one then. Most appearances for Tony
under
Pulis.
Me.
Which player has got the most appearances under Tony Pulis?
It'd have to be a Stoke player again, would it?
Yes.
Ryan?
Shawcross. Well done. Yeah, very, very good. Yeah. Second, Rory Delap. Third, Ricardo Fuller. Glenn Whelan. Andy Wilkinson. Wilco. Oh.
Yeah.
Robert Hoof and then Matthew Everington.
There's one there, Glenn Whelan. Right, so we signed Glenn from Sheffield Wednesday for about 500 grand. And a promotion year, we get promotion. And I'm looking at the team and I'm thinking, I need another midfield player. I'm not so sure Glenn will step up to it. So we get the lad from Wolves.
Kitely?
Olawojana.
Oh, Olawojana.
Yeah. So we bring him in. After about five or six games, Glenn gets in. Takes his place, plays all the games. The following year, I'm thinking, we just need that little bit more. Then I go out and get another midfield player. I think Palacios from Tottenham, take him. After about five or six games, Glenn steps up again, plays. And that's what he did all his life, honestly. And I have so much respect for him. He most probably hates me for trying to replace him all the time. But he, similar to what we talked about, he just went, right, that's the challenge.
Stepped it up
all the time, Ben. And as a lad, you know, if anybody's going to go into coaching, you know, people, you know, and there was people there who I think should be involved in coaching. Glenn should be one of them because his attitude and his application when he's down in the dumps is just phenomenal.
That's good, good resilience level.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah.
There was a player you mentioned there, Ben, Rory Delap.
Oof.
the throw-in.
The throw-in.
And you've got a funny story. Well, it's quite a famous clip, isn't it, of Boaz.
So obviously, you know Boaz at West Brom. But I actually texted him the other day. I said, can you remember any funny sort of Tony? And he went, to be fair, probably can't tell a lot of them. But yeah, there's a few. Anyway, he said, just ask him about the time when he was playing for Hull. And you're obviously Stoke manager, Rory Delap. Obviously it was that time where he was in his pomp of slinging it in the box. Yeah. And there's a famous clip going around the internet. And I know you don't watch much of the internet, Tony, but the ball basically, he's run out to the corner flag almost, Boaz has, right? And the player's shutting him down and he can either put the ball out for a throw-in or he can turn around.
kick it for a corner.
That's quick thinking though, isn't it?
It's genius is what it is. It's genius. Because at that moment in time, genuinely, a throw-in was more of a threat with a Rory Delap throw than a corner for Stoke City, wasn't it?
Well, we knew exactly where that throw-in was going and how flat it was. I'm not sure if Ben was there at the time, but we finished training the one day and the lads are having a competition over the far pitch on the training ground, Ben. Who can throw the ball the longest? And they've put 50 quid in or whatever they've done. And Kempy's watching them. I'm doing something with Wilco or Dicko, Cal Dickinson. So I'm doing something with the two young fullbacks. And then I walk over and Kempy comes over to me and says, have you seen Rory throw the ball?
This is class.
I've gone, no.
It was Kempy who discovered him. It was Kempy.
He said, I can't believe it. So they're all walking in. He's gone, Rory, come here. So he walks over. He said, show the gaffer. So he goes, and he throws her almost over the pitch. And I'm, Rory, where have you been hiding that? He said, he threw for his county, javelin thrower.
No.
Right, okay. And he's got ambidextrous or whatever in his
It can
shoulders.
Basically go over the
so
limit.
So he can actually get further than most people.
More leverage.
Yeah, more leverage. So we then talked about, we don't want it looped, we just want it thrown.
Yeah.
And then we used to have three positions that we took up. And one was one on the goalkeeper, if we could get in front, stop the goalkeeper coming to collect it. Then we'd have a near post movement and we'd have middle of the goal coming across the penalty spot and coming across the goalkeeper and one round the back. And people used to think, it just happens. But we used to work.
Without doubt you did,
We used to work at Stoke really, really hard on that.
It was murder to face, honestly.
And against
it was
the
murder.
Against the better teams where we needed to break the game up. We didn't want a free-flowing game, especially the first couple of years in the Premier League. You know, every time we stopped, and Rory then would be throwing it just inside our own half. Yeah. All the players would get fed up with the game, you know, the top players. Yeah. Oh my God, here we go again.
They would, though.
And it just broke the game up. But one story about Wenger, who was obviously synonymous with the Stoke supporters. We're playing him in the cup. We got him in the third, fourth round of the FA Cup at home. We've drawn him. And Patrick Vieira and Jens Lehmann were on a coaching course with me. I did a license down in South Wales, and the two lads were there. And they were waiting for me afterwards. I'm thinking, oh, blimey, what are they going to say to Arsenal players? We've absolutely mullered them most of the times at the Britannia at Bet365 Stadium. So they wait for me, and they tell me this story, and they say it was the only time Arsene Wenger ever, ever coached defensive work was when we played you in that cup game. And he said he had us there for about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour. This is where they throw it. This is what I want you to do. This is what I don't want you to do. You know, da, 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 da. You know, obviously the throw-in is that's how they usually beat us. So we worked all on this. And he said he was, I'd never known him so uptight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Going
in his head massively, yeah.
We're thinking, it's only Stoke. So anyway, we get there. And he says, we get there and the team comes through. Rory's not playing. So he says, not only does Rory not play, but you murder us 3-1. He says, Wenger comes in afterwards. He's lost for words. You know, usually he blames, we should ban throw-ins and we should do this, that and the other. He had nowhere to go.
Nothing to say. Fully in his head. Do you know which team you beat the most in your career?
God, blimey.
It's good, this. So in 20 matches against this team, you beat them 14 times.
West Brom?
Yes. It's West Brom.
Well, every time we start the season, whether we were in the Championship or the Premier League, and I was at Stoke, I used to go, there's 6 points.
Probably why they hired you, wasn't it?
It's so good.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And then next on the list, we had Fulham. 23 games, you beat them 9 times.
Yeah.
God, 5 games more you beat for West Brom. And then it was Reading, 9 wins. Palace, 9 wins. Sunderland, 8 wins. But yeah, even Arsenal beat them 5 times.
Yeah.
It's a good little record, that, isn't it?
And,
very good.
Ben, I think it's fair to say Tony likes the 1-0 win.
Oh, yeah.
It's so, talk to me about the...
I used to love a 1-0.
Told you. See, I told you. So I told these lads, I was trying to describe how much like a clean sheet meant to you.
We were howling in the office when you were...
It was so funny, though. I just remember, so we won 1-0. I can't remember who it was. I can't remember. But by the by, I'd had my shower and I'd come back out to the mirror and I was just sort of brushing my teeth and you've come next to me, you've got your towel on, you've just done the same thing, got out of the shower and you've just looked in the mirror at me while I'm brushing my teeth and gone, I love a 1-0 win. I love a 1-0 win. It's the best result in the world. Them fuckers, they're going home fuming. I'm just pissing myself laughing, brushing my teeth. It was brilliant, honestly. You and your towel there, just next to me. I was like, oh, this is class. Can we talk about the famous Serge Gnabry, please? Because I'm going to back you up on this one, okay? Because the internet loves to talk about this one. The internet loves all the clips. Everybody watches him playing.
Phenomenal
player. Week in, week out for Bayern Munich. And everybody's like, oh my God, how could Tony Pulis not see that Serge Gnabry was this sort of player? But tell your version of events. And I promise you, I will back you up on this as well.
Well, I'll start by saying that Kempe thought we had his twin brother to start with.
We haven't signed Serge.
Nah, Serge, you know, I had a phone call from Boldy, Steve Bold, and he said, listen, we've got this young lad. We thought he was going to be a real, real top player. And he struggled. He has really struggled badly with us. You know, we've done this and we've done that with him and everything else. Have you got room to take him? Just take him for a couple of months. And just, you know, make or break really for the kid. Because I don't think Arsene sees him as being part of the club. So I said, Boldy, let me find out. So I went and spoke to Jeremy and, let's take a chance on him. So I think Arsene were helping with his wages and everything else. So we take him and he turns up the first day. I think he had a silver suit on. What was it? One of those suits and, you know, white trainers with bobbles on and this, that and the other, which... I'm thinking this is not going to suit the
snazzy,
lads.
Snazzy, basically. Yeah, looking a bit snazzy.
This is not going to suit, you know, the McLeans and the Gardners and, you know, or the gang, you know. And so, anyway, training, Ben trained with him. He just never, ever, ever got near. Man, we had a good team then, Ben.
Yeah. Solid team.
We had a
workers.
We had a really, really good team. And to say that he was in front of Brunty or James Morrison or Fletch or whoever it was at the time is wrong. It just never clicked. And one instance sticks out massively for me, and that was the reserves were playing Aston Villa, which was a big game for West Brom. And I was going down to London to watch a first team game on a Monday night. And I said to Kempe, with Jimmy Shan, go with Jimmy. Have a look at Serge, see how he does, Dave. We've not been really over-impressed with him in training. And they took him off after 15 minutes. Now, I would always say to the person who was taking the reserves, don't ever do anything that you think suits me. Always do what your eyes see. So you see it, you believe it, you do it. Don't, you know, I'm big on that. You know, all this fluff and everything else that goes on, and people have got perceptions of this, and wash that away. Believe your own eyes. Jimmy took him off after 50 minutes. So I get in the next morning and I speak to Kempe, and Kempe said, nah, he's just miles off it. Absolutely miles off it. Now, you trained with him. What did you think?
Yeah, exactly. So he, again, good lad, but just just didn't really do anything, did he?
No.
I think the talent. Do you know? Oh, what?
He was a great lad. There was great, no, lad. Nothing wrong with
absolutely
him as a player.
I think the talent thing
no,
is.
Lad, sorry.
I think the talent thing of all of this is that people. What people don't like to mention is so he was on a year long loan that season. It got cut short of January. Basically, he went back to Arsenal in the January. He didn't play a game for Arsenal in the Premier League. He went back to Arsenal. So for the last 6 months of the season, I think he made one, maybe two like League Cup appearances, basically. But that was it. So even Arsenal could see at the time then, really.
Well, I think that he had been sort of like a very, very good player when he was younger.
Yeah, he
obviously
won some awards, didn't
yeah,
he? Yeah,
he had some talent. There was some talent there. I actually think West Brom did him the world of good.
Yeah.
I think he thought he was going to step into West Brom and just...
A reality check for
yeah,
him.
Yeah, do what he was doing at Arsenal, just saunter through and my talent will get me there. And it was no surprise to me when Arsenal sold him to Werder Bremen. You know, that people had told me he'd gone there and I thought, yeah, well... There's no way in a million years on what we've seen at West Brom that he could play for Arsenal. And fair play to the kid. He's had a most probably a kick up, biggest kick up the backside that you could possibly get. Mm. You know, stepping away from Arsenal and not even playing or being part of what we were doing at West Brom. And then having to go back there, still not getting the team. I think that summer, most probably, he's really cleared his mind. He's got his head on it. He's done brilliant there and then got the move to Munich and listen, he wasn't a bad lad
and
fair play to him. I've just spoken about Glenn Whelan and saying every year he'd prove me wrong and get back in the team and I have so much respect for him. I think the same with Serge, brilliant. He's had a great career and good luck to the boy. But at West Brom, as Kempy says, you know, we had his twin brother. We didn't have that player who's playing for Bayern Munich.
Oh, it's good.
Did we?
No, without doubt we didn't. I think I agree with you. I think it probably is. It's probably hit his ego a little bit. He thought he was going to come out and just absolutely rip it off at West Brom. It doesn't work like that, though. If you're going to fit into a West Brom team, especially a Tony Pulis West Brom, you're going to have to work your socks off first and foremost and then show your skill. Yeah. And he wasn't willing to do that at that time. But I think he's probably learned that to make a name for yourself, you have to do that, don't you? No matter where you are.
Ben, I've got a note on here that you sent me earlier on. All it says is Craig Dawson versus Swansea, last game of the season.
Ah, yes. Okay, yeah, another good funny story, actually, yeah. So, season, it's last game of the season. We're away at Swansea. We're 1-0 up at half-time.
We get beat 2-1, two late goals.
There you go. We got beat 2. You remember everything, by the way. Yeah. How many games have you managed? 1,300?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So, we got beat 2-1. And Dawes, for the last two, had a bit of a stinker. He just sort of got turned. He lost his way. He was trying to be a bit showy-offy. It's the end of the season. Anyway, we got into the changing rooms at full-time. And I'm just thinking, do you know what? We're mid-table. We're safe as houses. Yeah, we're safe as houses. Everybody's just going to go on holiday now and have a nice time. You absolutely unleashed on Dawes. You went mad at him, right? And to the point where I'm sort of sitting there thinking, maybe I should just say, like, all right, Gaffer, like, relax, yeah? We're going on holiday tomorrow, yeah? Do you know what I mean? And then I thought, and then do you know what, right? You kept going at him and I thought, no, I'm not going to say anything because I knew I was flying to Mallorca tomorrow, right? And I just didn't need the aggro. I didn't need it, right? So I thought, nah, Dawes, you're just going to have to take this one, mate. But you did. You went bonkers at him, didn't you?
Yeah. Listen, Dawes, I think I would criticise Dawes more than anyone else. But he was always picked. I always picked him. Never played a game, I think, at West Brom. Yeah. Without, if he was fit, he played.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And the career he's had, Ben, has been fabulous.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
A great, great attitude, haven't he?
Yeah.
Very single-minded. Mm. You know, I played him right back and people used to go mad with me playing, but he would do okay. But I can remember the one time we're playing at the Hawthorns and he gets the ball wide. I think you might have thrown it out and he had a touch out of his feet and he kicked it into the stand. And I walked over and I must have said it loud because it was two supporters started laughing. I said to Kempy, tell him he's got to keep the ball on the grass, on the grass, not in the stand. You know what Kempy was like, just... One of them. I love Dawes. Yeah, I thought he was fabulous. His goals, Ben.
Oh, he used to chip in, didn't he? Seriously.
We had at West Brom, we had players who were desperate to score.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about Brunty's free kicks and guards or corners or set plays, Mozza to an extent. They were very good, but you still need people who are desperate to score. And those, you know, Jonas, McCauley, Johnny Evans and Dawes. You know, what a four, fivesome that was.
Absolutely.
Used to fry. Yeah, and I think we went about seven games at home.
Oh, easy, yeah. Easy for sure.
Continuously scoring off a set player. The crowd used to get up.
I remember.
Get a corner and they just used to stand
the Arsenal
up.
Game, one of the Arsenal games in particular, we won Peter Checking goal for them. And I remember, I think we won 3-0 or 3-1 in the end or something like that. But every time we got the ball from a set piece, a corner, whatever it was, when the ball was about to go in the box, we knew that it was a very good chance of scoring it. And it was just relentless, wasn't it? You just knew what was going
to
happen.
But the lads had to want to score. And that was absolutely vital. You know, I can remember Jonas scoring a couple at Liverpool.
Oh, yeah.
When we drew with Liverpool. Gerrard scored late on, didn't he? Missed, which was a nuisance, but... That was 2-2 we drew there, and that was another game where every time we had a set play, I thought
we were going to score.
And what about another centre back partner? Because you always say quite possibly one of the most underrated players ever is Gareth McCauley, don't you?
Yeah,
Gareth, and what a lad as well.
Yeah, brilliant, wasn't he?
Wonderful lad. Good. Gareth was quick enough. He was brave as a lion, and a good footballer as well. But the balance, you know, we had, I love Jonas was off his head, but he was, again, he was another, a proper soldier. Top player. When you work with him, you look at him, he's a top player. You had him, you had those two. Obviously, Johnny was on a different level.
Yeah, he had class, didn't he?
Yeah, Johnny could play anywhere.
Yeah.
Johnny could play. You could play him. I did play him in midfield. He moaned like a drain about it for
He'd moaned about
weeks.
Anything.
Yeah, I know. Play him at right back, he'd moan. We talk about Wilfred Zaha. We got Palace, the one that we beat Palace 2-0 at Palace.
Yeah.
Wilfred was their best player. He was the only one that you looked at and you thought he'll cause us some problems. So I stuck Johnny at right back or left back or whatever. Never give him a kick.
Yeah.
And then come in afterwards, go, oh, Gaffer, I don't like playing now. You know, it kills me, you know, this, that. You know, John, you've just kept quiet, their best player for our team. That's all you've got to worry about, mate.
Do you think, just going back to the Dawsons and the McCauleys and the Olsons, and this, I sound like an old man saying this, but they don't make them like that anymore, do they? They don't, do they?
No. But we had, you know, like I say, you had that group of players who had been at West Brom for a long time. So there was, you know, that almost that togetherness that you needed to nurture. And the ones we brought in, Solomon, what's his name, Matty Phillips.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had McLean and people like that. They gelled well within what that group was about, and that was important. That was really important.
Tony, this is absolutely world class. Thank you. We just got a few sort of quick fire questions to finish. Okay. I'm going to start with one of the most difficult questions you would have faced today. Who is the favourite player that you've managed in your whole career?
Oh my goodness!
The one player that you go, yeah. Do you know what? I used to love that boy. This is a tough one. I know this is a tough one.
I got too many, Ben, honestly. If you got the different clubs, I thought Fletcher was brilliant.
Yeah, at West Brom.
At West Brom. I thought Darren was absolutely fantastic. At Stoke, there were so many. Walters, John, Rick. You know, I could go through the team there because of the times I've had there. And then the promotion year, the people there. It just, you know, Jedinek was a great captain at Palace. You know, so I had him. And then you go back to my Gillingham days and I had Andy Essen Tyler, who was a real, real soldier. Good player, top player, really. Now, there's too many, Ben. I couldn't pick one out.
What about the best? Was there ever a manager that you managed against and you just found it difficult, whether it be tactically or you just struggled to get one over them? Was there any ever a manager you kind of really thought about?
Yeah, it was most probably Pep when Pep took over Man City. I think Man City were just a step above anyone else. Mm. And that happened with the manager, Pellegrini, just before Pep took over as well. I just thought the thing that sticks and resonates with me was the 2011 Cup final. Mm. We played Bolton on the Saturday. We won 5-0. It was a great day for us. And the next day, Man United would play Man City. And people were saying to me, which team do you want to win? And obviously, I got the greatest respect for Sir Alex and Manchester United at the time, who were winning everything. But the team that was on the up and the team I thought would cause us most problems was City. And I was really, really disappointed that City beat United. Obviously, they beat us in the final 1-0. Kenwyn missed a great chance, but that's by Dubai. So, yeah, I lived through that stepping stone with Man City. And they were I found them very difficult to manage against.
That was Man City when they were first giving it a real go, weren't they? Kind of the Rocky Santa Cruz, Torre. Kind of Robinho, Torre, all them guys, yeah.
Absolutely fabulous.
Would you say that's probably the proudest moment of your managerial career, the FA Cup final?
No, we lost, Ben. I was gutted. I've never watched it back. I got beat. Man City beat us in the playoffs as well in 99. Again, something that should never have happened. We were 2-0 up. We were only about 4 or 5 minutes to go. And then Dickoff gets a deflected goal. Then we let another goal in injury time and get beat on penalties.
Is this Gellingham?
Yeah.
I remember this. Yeah. I remember watching this as a kid. 99.
That was the year that everything shone on Manchester.
Yeah.
Because that same year, United did the treble.
Treble, of course, yeah.
Nicky Weaver
was
in goal, wasn't he? Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So Man City had it. I think the luck against us and United against Bayern Munich. It's amazing. Those two clubs on that same year actually were minutes away from losing.
Yeah, completely different. Yeah.
And spun around for the two clubs and the two sides.
Tony, thank you so
much. I've got
much.
One more, Ben. Go on. I've got one more. And this is a question I've been dying to ask, actually. Is there one player where you've gone into a club as manager and you've maybe had a perception that they're a good player, but when you've got there, you've gone, I did not know he was that good? A player that surprised you, just how good they were.
Yeah, that's a difficult one.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of, I guess, semi-answered it with Glenn Ween, to a point.
No, I think they, because of Ben will tell you what I am with the team and everything else. What would surprise me at times was the quality players or the so-called quality players who you managed to turn around and were prepared to do the work that I wanted
as well
in the wide areas and up front. They're the ones who were the ones I'd go for. I'd always believe that my centre-halves and my defenders and the goalkeeper would be solid people. The ones that you needed to really, really put shifts in at times are your wide players and your forwards. And I used to always think, my wide players, my forwards, if I could turn them round, especially, you know, we had Pennant, who was a scallywag for years and years and years. We took Jermaine, and Jermaine worked so hard the first year we had him, it was frightening. Matty Etherington, we took Matty from Tottenham. And Matty, again, you know, the work that Matty had put in. And when we got promoted, I had Creswell and Liam playing wide. You know, the two fullbacks, what I used to do in the Championship, the two fullbacks would tuck in and we'd almost play like six at times. Mm. And those two would do the work. You know, they got 15 and 14 goals for us. And, you know, the work that they did up and down, you know, it was just absolutely phenomenal. So that, and I even, you know, Rick would even, you know, Rick had run around, you know, to the best of his ability, and most probably the most he ever did for any other manager. But, you know, an unbelievably talented person, but was prepared to do that extra work. So they would be all those players who've played wide for me or played up front. You know, I hold my hands up and say thanks very much because without them, I don't think we'd have been as successful.
Fantastic.
Brilliant, Tony. Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
You're okay.
Thank you, Tony.
World class. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thanks, everybody, for watching. We hope you enjoyed the latest episode of the Fozcast. Don't forget to give us a follow on Spotify. Up the Fozcast.